The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
American analysts are primarily concerned about an invasion of Taiwan, right? That's the worst case scenario. But if you're a Taiwan military officer, you've really got three scenarios. The first one is they seize one of the offshore islands. So then what do you do about it? You know, that's the reason Taiwan still has a Marine Corps. They still have two Marine Corps brigades. They still have some amphibious landing ships. We might say, what are you doing with those? Well, you need them for those islands. And then the other issue that keeps them up at night, and maybe not as big to Washington, is, you know, this idea of a blockade, gray zone warfare. Can, you know, the PLA interfere with shipping? Taiwan is very dependent on imported energy.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 60, The Making of Taiwan's Military, with Dr. Eric Setzkorn. For many observers, Taiwan's security story begins with today's headlines. Chinese military pressure, growing concerns about deterrence, questions about the future of the Taiwan Strait. Yet Taiwan's security story did not begin in the 21st century. It stretches back more than 75 years to an army in exile, a society under martial law, and the remarkable transformation of both into one of Asia's most vibrant democracies. Understanding Taiwan's military today requires understanding that journey. Today, we'll explore what that history teaches us about military power, resilience, and deterrence in the Indo-Pacific. Joining us is Dr. Eric Setzkorn, historian of East Asia military affairs and author of the forthcoming book, On the Brink, A Military History of Taiwan. Eric Setzkorn, welcome to Dialogue.
Excellent. Glad to be here. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I think you hit on a number of absolutely critical points that the situation we have with Taiwan in the 21st century not only has its roots 75, 80 years ago, but for the United States, there's such a close connection to the story of how Taiwan's military as an institution has developed, evolved, grown, and changed. That I think understanding that history, that ongoing evolution is very important to taking the next steps into the future.
Oh, fantastic. Eric, before we explore Taiwan's military history, I mean, tell us a little bit about On the Brink. What inspired you to write it? What central message do you hope that the readers take away? Tell us a little bit.
Sure. I think a lot of this had to do with my personal background. I spent a lot of time in East Asia. I was in the U.S. Army. Many years ago, and then I've also worked in the intelligence community. I've been in Washington, D.C. now for nearly 20 years, and I'm always surprised how many people have contact with East Asia. Most folks in the Army, for example, have been to Korea for a year. Many folks in the Navy have been to Japan, maybe on assignment. But, you know, when you're there for a year, 18 months, you get a glimpse of a country. You get maybe a anecdotal impression of what it's like. Perhaps you work with the military in that host country, maybe you don't, but really there's a generational change that's going on in East Asia that we've seen not just since 2000, but going back to 1950. And I think the United States' role has changed profoundly. And I think understanding the drivers, the motivators of that, in Taiwan, for example, take an issue like conscription, something, you know, we might say, well, you need to have conscription because you need a large number of forces, you know, particularly for the army to be able to oppose any invasion. But that's also a sensitive subject if you had a population that was under martial law for over 40 years. And so these kind of issues, if we can better understand what countries like Taiwan have gone through, we can better situate ourselves for the future. And that was really something that I thought was connecting those pieces, connecting the history to the current events, the current issues, was something I wanted to do in my research.
Fantastic. You know, I read your book cover to cover, and it's coming out soon. U.S. Naval Institute Press, I think it comes out in August. Mm-hmm. And so everybody encouraged them to pick it up and read it. And you know, one of the things that I found most compelling is that your book reminds us that, you know, the security story didn't begin with today's cross-strait tensions, as I talk about it. I mean, it began with an army that was in exile, and I really found it really, you know, just drew me in. So what kind of military was that? And what were the defining challenges of those early years?
Certainly. Well, there was no shortage of challenges in the early years. The U.S. role in the story really begins at Taiwan in 1949, but we can actually see, the United States had a very strong role going back to World War II, working with the Chinese, training. You might think of the Flying Tigers, Joseph Stilwell, training those forces. But obviously, after 1945, the Chinese Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army, swept those forces in front of them, occupied the majority of China, and we have the exodus, if you will, of about 1.2 million people. Roughly 400,000 of that 1.2 million were military personnel. So they're arriving in Taiwan in 1949. They really don't know what to expect. This is a Taiwan had been controlled by Japan as a colony from 1895 until the end of World War II. So none of them are from Taiwan. They're an army in exile. And this is the moment where Harry Truman, he kind of washes his hands, if you will, with Chiang Kai-shek, with the Nationalist Party, with the KMT, that's the dominant party in China. And there's been too many broken promises, too many investments of money, of equipment that never paid off. And so there's an expectation, I think, in 1949 that this Republic of China on Taiwan, give it a year, maybe 18 months tops. But very quickly, this army, this military starts to rebuild itself. They're helped by some absolutely amazing leaders, one of whom I point out in the book, a guy named Sun Lijian, a graduate of VMI. He also studied at Purdue. Very much a he's not politically connected at all. In fact, he's kind of an outsider, but he's really good at training soldiers. He's really good at, putting some vigor back into this broken, dispirited army. And they're also helped by, fortuitous events. In this case, the invasion of South Korea by North Korea, which leads the United States to re-engage. And particularly during the Eisenhower administration, massive amounts of advisors, equipment, culminating in 1954 when you have a mutual security treaty signed. And so it's an amazing story where in the early 50s you go from an island on the brink of really invasion despair to by the mid 50s you have an army, a navy, an air force which have been rebuilt, re-equipped, retrained, and there's many on Taiwan by 1955 who are saying it's time for us to take the offensive again, which just shows you how in 6 years, how there'd been a complete 180 in the military fortunes of Taiwan. And I should say that was an investment the United States made. That was a very Eisenhower in particular. He's looking for bargains, and he found one in Taiwan and said, here's a military organization that's down on its luck. We can reinvigorate it and get it back to where it could be a useful partner for the United States.
You know, my second book in 2005, I published it with the Naval Institute Press. It was North Korean People's Army. And I looked at the origins and I asked myself, in addition to understanding the origins, how they played, how they continued to inform, the forces of today. And so let me ask you that question now. So, you know, how much of that legacy that you just described still shapes Taiwan's armed forces today?
Quite a bit. And I think one of the big ways it plays a role is that during the 1950s, there's a number of clashes on these outer islands, which, especially Americans, we like to think of Taiwan, it's Taiwan, it's one island. But there's a series of crises, Matsu and Quemoy. We now call them Kinmen and Matsu. And those islands are successfully held. And one of the things that has often confounded American leaders is, it's great that they were held, but up until today, there's still a challenge. How do we, for example, Taiwan has this challenge of how do you maintain control over those islands, which are a lot closer, in many cases to the coast of China than they are to Taiwan. So that's just one example where the territorial legacies of the past have kind of shaped. If we look at where the Chinese PLA conducts a lot of exercises, it's around a lot of those outer islands, which were also a crisis spot during the 50s, and which are still, could be a point of friction, a point where, if there were a conflict to occur, it might occur over one of those small islands.
Yeah, you pull that out in your closing chapter of the book, and I found that quite interesting to think about how these things could play out. So Taiwan evolved from a party army that was operating under martial law into the military of one of, I don't know, Asia's most vibrant democracies. So how did that transformation change the relationship between Taiwan's military, its government, and its society?
That's a good question, because I think, Taiwan's certainly not alone in this. That if we look at, for example, South Korea during the 1950s and 1960s, the military was often a tool of the leadership as much as it was defending against North Korea. The Philippines, similar case. Taiwan is an even more extreme case in that. This group of 1.2 million people that come over in 1949, the military is their last line of resort. And they keep tight control over it. There's purges of the officer corps. Hundreds of officers are arrested, suspected of being communists. Loyalty to the party is paramount. There's a system of political officers that are within the military. It's kind of funny that if you look at an old diagram, for example, the order process in Taiwan's army in the 1950s, the political officer has a little box he has to sign before the order can become valid. So it's a very, very, something here in the United States we might say is a little bit odd, but this is an army that was designed to keep those in power in power. But that really starts to change over the years, especially in the 1970s, 1980s. A younger generation is more concerned about having an army that can, fight, be active, be a learning organization. And so there's a gradual movement towards more opening. Martial law is lifted in 1987, but still it takes decades. It's not until 1999, just to give you one anecdote, the chief of the general staff, the highest ranking military member in Taiwan, until 1999, all of the men who had served in that role weren't born in Taiwan. That's how tightly controlled this little group of 1.2 million people had maintained power over the majority of the population by keeping that tight control over the military. But by the 1990s, 2000s, that eroded, and we started to see what we think of as a liberal democratic, Samuel Huntington style military officer corps that we would think of in the United States.
Yeah, no, I found that parallels in other militaries as I read that, and it is indicative of the how precarious it is to give power to a military, whether you can trust them, and it's often long before you have a professionalization. It's based on relationships and stuff, and I've seen this other places. But let me ask you a bit of a maybe a chicken and egg type question. So, is Taiwan democratized? Did the military become stronger because the military changed or because Taiwanese society changed? How do you see that?
So I think there was a core generation of political leaders in the 1990s and 2000s. One of the things about Taiwan is that even the opposition party, the DPP, they recognize that there are really severe security threats to Taiwan. So this can't just become a matter of, firing people from the military, downsizing the budget. You're going to have a military. That's just, it's going to be a big part of, the policy of the Republic of China, Taiwan. And so there was a group of really, I think, savvy political leaders in the 1990s, 2000s who said, we need that military expertise. And they restructured the Ministry of Defense to bring in more civilian leadership, to bring in more, how shall I put this, contrasting voices within the military. And I think in the long term, the goal was to provide a cultural change in the military. Let me give you an example. Military journals. I love to read military journals. In the Army, you have Parameters published by the War College. The Navy has the Naval War College Review. Taiwan's the same way. All these military schools, they have their own journals. If you read them from the 1970s and 80s, they are absolutely boring. All they do is regurgitate whatever the boss says. If the general says something, the colonels say, "Wow, that's a great idea, general." By the 2000s, 2010s, you're starting to have that cultural change where you have military officers say, "Hey, here's a new, I was thinking about how we could use a different approach to how our Navy does patrols. Hey, here's a different way we can do our training that's maybe a little more effective." And I think that opening the civilian leaders opened the door and allowed for sort of that cultural change within the military itself. So it is kind of they have to work together, and they realized they needed to work together. And I think the fruits of that were mutually beneficial.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about adapting to change. So, I mean, one of the themes that runs through your book is that Taiwan has repeatedly had to adapt to changing military and strategic realities. I mean, you just kind of spoke a little bit about that. So, if you had to identify two or three adaptations that most strengthen Taiwan's security, what might that be? Help us understand that.
Well, I need to talk about the US first, because that's the biggie. And I should note for the record, the disclaimer, these are my personal views and don't represent any organization I've worked for, the US federal government. But the big challenge, if you're a senior ranking military officer in Taiwan, and this is the same challenge you've had for 75 years, the United States role, because the United States has been a fantastic partner. But the United States is a global power. It has global interests. And so, for example, the 1950s, Taiwan is a hotspot. It's on the front lines of freedom. Eisenhower is, rolling down Taipei streets in a Cadillac, cheering to the crowds. Well, guess what? In the 1960s, the big issue was Vietnam. So, how much new equipment, how much attention, how much foreign aid does Taiwan get in the 1960s? Not a whole lot. 1970s, it gets good for a while under Nixon, but then it gets worse under Carter. Carter has other interests, other priorities. The United States is, again, during the 1980s, 1990s, for a long time, was trying to have a rapprochement with China. That kind of ends with Tiananmen Square in 1989, but more importantly, the Third Taiwan Strait Crisis in 1996, when a lot of Americans kind of, say, oh yeah, we forgot about this ongoing potential hotspot in East Asia. And I think we've seen that under since 2000. So that's the big part, is how do you navigate this understandable, pendulum swing, if you will, of a lot of US attention, but then the US attention goes elsewhere. That I think is really of the one thing that people, if you're on Taiwan, social problems, cultural problems, budget problems, that can all be somewhat handled. But this US relationship, which is critical but uncertain, that's really a big question mark. It was in 1949. I think for a lot of people, it is today as well.
I love the way you describe that out. And I think that many people would probably say, well, 96, when we had the Third Taiwan Strait Crisis, that wasn't that long ago. At least in my mind, it wasn't. And yet, you bring out in the book about how because we had been engaging much more with China, we had to strengthen our relationship with Taiwan a bit. We hadn't been is tightly engaged, clearly not like we are today, and that there are real I don't know, ramifications, repercussions from the sine wave of close and less close relationships, and you kind of bring that out there a bit. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think, one of the smartest things that I came across in the book, in 1955, the United States sets up a U.S. Taiwan Defense Command. They'd come through the first Taiwan Straits crisis and said, boy, coordination isn't great. We have, Pacific Command. There was a MAG, which had about 3,000 folks on Taiwan, led by an Army two-star. But coordination hadn't been very good. So they set up U.S. Taiwan Defense Command. So it's got a direct line to Honolulu. And they put a Navy three-star and Air Force two-star as his deputy. And then you have an Army two-star on the island running the MAG. And what that does is it gives you a heck of a lot of stars to keep those programs going, to make sure someone has a voice, that they have a seat at the table, so to speak. And so sometimes we know political will is going to change. Budgets are going to go up and down. But within the military, I think sometimes those smart decisions to say, hey, this is a relationship that we need to really not just cultivate, but ensure it's functioning year after year. That's something where I think, fortunately, I think we're in a better place now that sine wave is in a pretty good location compared to where it was, say, for example, in 1992 or 1980s or 1978. But hopefully military leaders can try to give structure, give a foundation, give a framework so that when those tough times come, that communication, that back and forth dialogue can continue.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's pull a little bit about on the foundations of power. I mean, a central theme of your book is that military power, it isn't built by weapons alone. So here's a question. How have Taiwan's democracy, its institutions, economy, its international partnerships, how have those contributed to its security?
Sure. And that's one of the things. It was kind of nice to write the book because in some ways it does have a happy ending, right? This is we might look at the world today and say, oh, Chinese threats, they're sailing ships around Taiwan, they're doing, flybys down the Taiwan Strait all the time. But I would argue that we're in a better place than we were in the 1950s. Because if we look at where we were in the 1950s, in 1955, Taiwan's top exports were sugar, rice, and a little bit of tea. That was about 90% of their foreign exports. Now we look at what we have today. Number one, semiconductors, silicon chips, AI. That is just a vastly different skill set that is being shown by Taiwan's economy. And that in turn means rather than just provide Taiwan with weapons, with equipment, they can do a lot of that themselves. In the 1950s, again, men would have been drafted. It wasn't a democracy. They were basically, dragooned into the military for 2 years. It was often very brutal, often by people who spoke a different dialect, people had different values. I hate to say they would have been, in a real war, they would have been looked at as cannon fodder. Now we have people who are, if you're a 19-year-old young man, which is the age of conscription in Taiwan, you can vote. You're part of the political process. You're probably much better educated. You actually understand kind of the world around you and why you're needing to serve in the military. And that's just a fundamentally, I think, more solid basis for national security. If there would have been a large scale conflict, it would have been very brittle. I think today, look at what you see in Ukraine, that a population which is believes in what they're doing, feels like what they're doing is justified, right? Has tremendous resilience, tremendous staying power, and an ability to support a military for a long-term conflict.
Yeah. So let me pull on this a bit. So you spoke about the society and that helps us think a little bit deeper on this. But if military power ultimately rests on the strength of a society, then where do you see that Taiwan is strongest today?
I think if I had to choose one area today, I'd say the innovation aspect is probably the strongest. I'm tremendously impressed when I read a lot of what Taiwan is doing with, drones and these undersea vehicles and robotics. There's a desire, I think, to be innovative. We hear the term asymmetric a lot of times, a willingness to take chances. And understanding that there's no perfect solutions. And I'm tremendously heartened too, because when I read a lot of things, in the past, you would have had military officers in Taiwan maybe looking to the United States and saying, okay, if the U.S. Army restructures around brigade combat teams, maybe we should do that too. If the U.S. Navy buys Perry-class destroyers, maybe we should do that too. But now I think there's a self-confidence, there's a ability to take chances that the people of Taiwan, both in the political sector, society, and in the military, are willing to say, we can do things a different way, and I think that'll maybe have a good fit for their security needs, whether that be, for example, Taiwan's developing a whole bunch of mine layers. That's not something the U.S. Navy really has done a whole lot of, but it's a different tactic. It's something. It's not kind of a, super expensive. It's not flashy, but it'll probably be very effective. A lot of drones and short-range fired missiles for any landing defenses. It may be more effective than a high-priced fighter jet, and I think that sort of willingness to take bold military judgments is something that I think is going to. It means that in the future, adaptation is going to occur, right? They're not just going to stick with one set formula and hope it works. They're going to adapt, evolve, change, react. And I think that's going to be a positive thing going into the late 2020s.
If I pull on that just a minute, and you talk about the overall security concept. Is that right? The OSC, the porcupine
Overall defense concept, yeah.
strategy. Defense concept, ODC, the porcupine strategy. Just a minute ago, your description reminded me of Admiral Paparo's hellscape discussion. I mean, these are all examples of innovation and adaptation that you're talking about. Is that right?
Yeah, I think certainly. So that's a very fascinating subject because a lot of this goes back to the early 2000s when you start having kind of a pushback. Taiwan for many, many years had basically said we want these big, kind of cool, exciting weapon systems. Whether that be the F-16, or we want for example during the late 90s they tried very hard to get Arleigh Burke destroyers. And there was a feeling that maybe those aren't exactly matching up with Taiwan's security needs, that feeling here in the United States. And so yeah, this debate has been ongoing really since the late 2000s, but particularly this overall defense concept of the 2010s, maybe not go fully in this sort of asymmetric area. And the reasons are complex because I think this is a difference, which I hope I highlighted in the book. American analysts are primarily concerned about an invasion of Taiwan, right? That's the worst case scenario. But if you're a Taiwan military officer, you've really got three scenarios. The first one is they seize one of the offshore islands. So then what do you do about it? That's the reason Taiwan still has a Marine Corps. They still have two Marine Corps brigades. They still have some amphibious landing ships. We might say, what are you doing with those? Well, you need them for those islands. And then the other issue that keeps them up at night and maybe not as big to Washington is, this idea of a blockade, gray zone warfare. Can, the PLA interfere with shipping? Taiwan is very dependent on imported energy. So that asymmetric component is probably really good for the third scenario, the invasion of Taiwan itself. Maybe not as useful for the other two scenarios. So it's an interesting time because if you're a defense planner, you have to sort of balance those three, right? So a drone might work really well for option or scenario three, defending Taiwan. You can't fly a drone 200 miles and have it kind of maybe patrol the gray zone the same way you could have a Navy destroyer. So it's there's no perfect solution. And I think that's what makes it interesting, but that's also what makes it a very a delicate balancing act between Taiwan, the United States, and how that risk is evaluated.
Let me pull you a little bit further on this then, and ask you, so what other, biggest misconceptions people have when they think about Taiwan's military?
I think one of the biggest challenges, I think, moving forward, I actually think, is not so much the PLA. One of the things that I I keep looking at and kind of, keeps drawing my attention. Demographics. Something we don't think about really here in the United States because we're a big country, right? There 330 million people. We can generally find enough volunteers to go into the military. Some years a little less, some years more. Taiwan is a much smaller country, and their birth rate has been low for a while. And what that means is, whereas 25 years ago, you might have had 200,000 young men turning 19, that magic age, they could be drafted for a year. Now you've got 100,000. That's starting to get down where, with medical deferments and maybe hardship, issues, there's just not a lot of healthy young people to serve in the military. And that's going to change. For example, I'll give you a case of the Navy. In the 1980s, Taiwan still had some old Gehring destroyers. They needed about 350 people on a Gehring destroyer. Now, mostly they have a lot of Perry class. They call them the Chung'un class, maybe 175 people. But if you look at like the Japanese, they have a ship, the Mogami class, really 90 people. And that somewhat you're going to start seeing, I think, issues like demographics are going to impact strategy just because if you don't have enough, 19-year-olds, you can't just put a whole lot of infantry on the beach. You have to come up with a different solution. And I think that's something that I think is going to be a severe constraint for Taiwan in the future. Because 22 million people, that sounds like a lot, but as the population ages and has fewer children, something's got to give.
Yeah, I did a episode on recently on the changing character of war, and I was talking about how going forward we're likely to see where one person controls many platforms, where you described many people on a single platform. That'll be very helpful for our East Asian partners that are in fact struggling very concretely with these declining population to be able to pull and recruit people from. You spoke, we've kind of talked a little bit about this enduring partnership throughout our time together today. And so, over 7 decades, this U.S.-Taiwan relationship, I mean, it's been about much more than security assistance. But how has that partnership shaped the evolution of Taiwan's military institutions? How do you see that?
I mean, I think there's been a huge impact. First off, one of the ways is educational. I mean, one of the things I'm always struck by when the United States military advisors got there in the 1950s, the term military advisor, makes it seem like they get in and kind of start telling people what to do. Generally, most military advisors, mostly what they do is collect information. But when the US showed up in the 1950s, one of the things they did was build the school system. They set up, a war college, all the service academies, the quartermaster school and the armor school and all these different training facilities. And that has, over time, I think, perpetuated a culture of learning, which has been tremendously positive. It has also meant that there's been easy contact. Even during periods when the United States and Taiwan haven't been particularly close, educational exchanges, they still send cadets to West Point, to Annapolis, to the Air Force Academy. They send Navy personnel to the Bud School. They send Army personnel to Ranger School. F-16s that Taiwan has purchased, well, they still, they're being trained in Arizona, right? So those educational exchanges have been a tremendous kind of backbone for the relationship for the past 75 years. The other thing I think is tremendously beneficial increasingly now is that many, especially younger Taiwanese, they look at the US example of how to operate as a joint force. That's a huge, huge, I think, aspect. If you look at publications in Taiwan, they say, well, United States, even if its forces are a small percentage, perhaps, of a coalition, they can operate efficiently because they're integrated well and they communicate well and they have wonderful, sensor fusion and all these buzzwords that I'm probably out of date on, but they look at the US as a wonderful example that they can say, that's how you get the most bang for the buck. That's how you become an effective force, is to operate in that kind of fluid, cohesive style between Army, Navy, Air Force, space, cyber, all mixed in together.
Yeah, that education as a foundational aspect of our relationship. I saw it in we did the same what you described in Taiwan. We did in South Korea, even in the early tens when I was doing the Afghanistan problem. We were setting up schools there to whether it was all types of schools, the service of the combat armed schools, the different schools, so that they could develop forces that were capable and enduring. And of course, just like you were describing, they sent people to our courses back in the United States as well as we were creating them there. But let's talk about lessons in the future. I mean, so Taiwan's experience, I mean, I think it may offer lessons well beyond the Taiwan Strait. So if another small democracy was facing a large adversary, and they were, studying Taiwan's experiences, what lessons do you think that they should take away from that?
I think one of the lessons, again, if I was, sitting in Taipei, maybe not sitting in Washington, but indigenous production. That's something that has been a major, really, since the 1960s. So obviously, during, the 1950s, the United States had tons of surplus equipment. We had M1 Garands and World War II destroyers. Here you go, more than you could ever want. Howitzers, you name it. As time has gone on, that has become more of a problem. I mean, the United States is just not producing as much for its own military, and then there's less sort of equipment that can be transferred. And Taiwan, that was always seen as this might be a factor in shaping our policy, and also it's an irritant. It's an irritant because, for example, let's say you're a small country like Taiwan. You have to, present a list in Washington and say, oh, here's five things we'd like. We'd like some M1 Abrams. We'd like some Harpoon missiles. We'd like some AMRAAM missiles. And some will say, we'll get back to you. And it's a little bit, it creates friction. And I think that beginning in Taiwan in the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, there was a big effort to a lot of stuff that was blown up, destroyed. It was taken to Taiwan for refurbishment, fixing. Taiwan also, their maritime industries, shipbuilding, has grown tremendously, especially in the last 30 years. And I think as Taiwan's domestic industry has gotten better, it has lessened some of the pressure on equipment transfers being the relationship, right? Because a partnership, not a treaty ally, but a security partnership, if you can focus on things like training, on operational planning, that's good. And if if you can get rid of this sort of the nuts and bolts, make sure that smaller country feels secure, they feel like they can protect themselves, they don't have to go begging, if you will, for American weapons. I think that's been that's a good thing to kind of make sure there's a basis of equality, make sure things are on a solid foundation, solid footing.
Yeah, one more question, thinking about the future. So, if we were having this conversation, say 10 years from now, what developments would tell you that Taiwan had successfully strengthened deterrence? And what developments would concern you most?
I think of the things that I would look for if I was just reading the paper, Taiwan's Navy, right now, in terms of, and I say right now, as a historian, right now could mean 20 years ago. So perhaps I should qualify that. But really, since 2000, Taiwan's doctrine, its spending, its operational approach, it pains me to say this as someone who's in the army, but the Navy has really dominated forward thinking. So I would look at what Taiwan's Navy is doing. If they're procuring, for example, surface forces, That means they're maybe looking to, they're really concerned about that gray zone operations, counter blockade. If they're really charging full steam ahead with submarines, with anti-ship missiles, that means they're maybe doing that more asymmetric approach because they're worried about an invasion of Taiwan. That's really the thing that I would look for. The thing that a lot of Americans always look for is the budget. And I think the budget, that's a tricky way to view defense affairs, because there can be a lot of supplementals, a lot of sleight of hand, a lot of indigenous production. So I would look more at sort of the doctrine, the approach, and the types of acquisitions for Taiwan. That'd be something if I was looking to 2035, I would keep an eye on.
And what would concern you the most?
I was stalling a little bit on that one, but I think the thing that would concern me the most, I've been very, I think, positive about some of the developments in East Asia recently regarding Japan with the Philippines, right? This first island chain. I think they all recognize that there's some pretty big concerns with China. I would be more concerned if, for example, the Philippines or Japan would, have a rapprochement with China, because it really is one of those situations where a united front, together they're much stronger. Even if, for example, there was a clash over one of these smaller islands and Japan or the Philippines wasn't directly involved, if they were at least supportive of, for example, a maritime transit, if they, tried to, made the right vocalizations about, freedom of the seas, I think that's a very good thing. But if there was one of those folks would peel off, would maybe make a, some sort of, step back from that situation, I think that would be a tremendously negative impact for Taiwan and also the U.S. role in East Asia. So that's what I would fear. That's more of almost a diplomatic rather than a military issue. But that's I think what I would think would be most negative for Taiwan's
Yeah.
military.
No, that's good. We've got several audience questions, and so I
Okay.
want to get some of those. And so let's. So the first one is asking about defense priorities. And so, if Taiwan could make only one major defense investment over the next decade, where would that investment have the greatest strategic impact?
I mean, I can just go by, things I've picked up, things I've read. So I mean, if there's a closely held plan, but it definitely seems like the there's been a tremendous investment in drones and missiles. This idea, you mentioned the hellscape earlier. I think that's an attractive thing for political leaders and military leaders, because it's you're spending a lot of money at home. You're not buying American weapon systems, which everybody likes to, buy, give people in your district jobs. And it's also something where it has that deterrent value, I think, for China. If it was just me, the thing that I was struck by is that, Taiwan's reserve system, it's been bad for really about 30 years. Their reserve system is not like we have in the United States, where generally reserve personnel in the United States, they might be assigned to a unit or they might have their own equipment, which they'll fall in on. In Taiwan, the reserve system is much more of a, you show up for 5 days, a couple times after your military service, and you do some paperwork. And any sort of sustained conflict, that's just going to be very difficult to integrate those folks into any sort of operation. They don't have any like unit equipment. So that's something where I'm always struck by that. That just seems like a giant hole that needs to be fixed. But I think missiles and drones are a little more sexy and cool than reserve systems and sort of training supporting personnel.
I want to pull you a little bit further on talking about the reserves and why that matters when we think about type of conflict they're going to have. You laid that out in the closing of your book, but coupled with that, this next question is asking about, you know, the conscription, and you've talked about it a couple times already through the episode, but I think it'd be helpful if people understood at least presently the conscription practice, because they've got conscription, they've got volunteer systems, and how these weave together. And then along with, you know, the reserves you spoke about. But the question is asking, what role should conscription play in Taiwan's future defense strategy? Weave this all together, if you will, and help the audience better understand what you're getting after.
Yeah, so the question, you know, how do you get a large supply of trained personnel? It was very easy in the 1970s, 1980s. You get drafted at age 19, you get a letter in the mail for the next 2 years. You're assigned to an Army division, Navy ship, an Air Force base. There was an attempt in the 2000s to create a volunteer force, the idea that society is changing. Young men don't like spending as much time in the military. Many of these by this point are only children. That's a very big factor in Taiwan society. They looked at the example of the United States and said, yes, you know, if you're especially a highly skilled military trade, a year, 2 years where you're forced to be there is not really the best to learn that skill. Unfortunately, there was a couple scandals. There were some issues with kind of the rollout of the volunteer system. The pay wasn't that great. The benefits, you know, when you transition from a conscription-based force to a volunteer-based force, a lot of little things crop up, like, daycare facilities, like quality of the barracks, right? Nobody really cares if a conscript, they don't like the barracks. They're just there for a year. But if you're asking people to just sign up for 3-4 years, you got to invest a lot of money in sort of those kind of quality of life things. Where we're at now, though, it was for a brief period of time, just 4 months of conscription for about 6-7 years in the late 2000s, but it's back up to a year. And this is a tricky issue if you're a politician, right? Because ideally for a military officer, you want folks to be around longer. They need more time to really become knowledgeable about what it means to be in the military, to do their job. But is that politically viable? Probably not. Are more people slowly but surely volunteering? I think the numbers are positive in that direction, that over time, the other X factor here is that you want people in civilian life as a whole to have some of those skills, military skills, so you can, if there were a big conflict, maybe have them rejoin the force, if you will. So there's a number of different balls to juggle here. The other factor too, people cost money. You know, in the 1960s, when you drafted someone, it didn't cost you much. If you're taking an engineer who works for NVIDIA and saying, hey, guess what? For the next 6 months, you're going to be working on this missile Corvette, as you know, that you're going to have to pay him more, right? It's just, there's a lot of factors there. The United States, it really took us, you know, almost a decade, I would say, before a lot of those issues got fixed, and that you saw in the 1980s, this kind of renaissance in the U.S. military. I think Taiwan is still dealing with those. I think there's no easy answer. There's no good answer. But it's going to take a lot of little adjustments, little fixes to get that where it needs to be.
And then on the reserves, you know, your book, you talk about the reserve units, level A's, B's, and C units, and their level of readiness and you know, conscripts that you know, that fill some of these units perhaps. And so just say more.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's very different that, for example, in Iraq and Afghanistan, you had Army Reserve and National Guard Brigade Combat Teams. They need some training. They need some time to kind of spin up. But after that, they're deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan, right? And they were a vital part of the U.S. effort for over a decade, right? The U.S. Army just wasn't big enough to sustain that with active duty forces. If there was ever a conflict, I mean, you know, heaven forbid, but, you know, there's a hundreds of thousands of men who have been conscripted, who have served in the military, how do you integrate them into a high tech, fastly moving, very lethal environment? I think, it's going to be forcing people to do more training, right? There's already been some movement to, have people start to do instead of 5 or 7 days, every couple years. Maybe they need to do 2 weeks, maybe they need to do 3 weeks. But that's still very different than like we see with like the Israeli system, right? Where people kind of know, they can fall in on their equipment, they can fall in with their army unit or whatever and be ready to go, in sometimes a matter of hours or days. I mean, that's just, it's a very expensive, it takes a long time to build up that kind of organizational structure. And then here's another twist to this, right? Taiwan, if you look at it on the map, it seems like a fairly decent sized island, but most of it's mountainous. Where are these folks going to train? If you want these folks to go out there and, in the United States, we have NTC, we have JRTC, we have all these opportunities because we're a big country. The Air Force can fly all over Nevada and blow things up. But if you're on a pretty small island that's densely populated, how do you get folks to do that kind of training, that refresher training that's needed? That's another, there's no easy fix to that. There was no easy fix to that in the 1970s. There's no easy fix to that today. And so it's a, there's a number of kind of these, I wouldn't call them problems, but they're limitations. These are limitations which are enduring, and we have to find ways to mitigate them, even if we can't solve them.
Yeah, no, thanks for that deeper explanation. I think that was helpful. So this next question is asking about what surprised you most during your research for On the Brink?
I was surprised by how bad the relationship was in the 80s and 90s. The relationship in the 80s and 90s was almost non-existent
Between the United States and Taiwan.
between the United States and Taiwan. We had, again, this was the era of it's still the Cold War, but back in the 1980s, the United States, for example, sold engines for naval destroyers. We sold two of those to the Chinese. At the same time, we declined to sell those to Taiwan. During the 1996, the level of communication during the Third Taiwan Straits crisis was so limited. Basically, that we had a couple folks fly over from Taiwan and just kind of pull out a map. And we have oral histories from that period. And the United States say, oh, how many units do you have? How many ships do you have? Basic, Foreign Military 101. Let alone, think about being able to talk to each other, being able to communicate. There was just an absolute laissez-faire attitude. I understand this was kind of a, especially in the early 90s, a unipolar moment. But it just seemed like, again, the legwork, that like basic level, hey, let's have a couple conferences. Hey, if I ever need to get a hold of you, what frequencies do you use? How many ships do you have? What kind of ships? What's their readiness rate? Where ports do they use if you're in the Navy? That kind of basic stuff was just, no one was doing it. And I can't really figure out, I don't know, folks have gone fishing. I don't know what was going on.
Yeah, no, I mean, clearly relationships were changing. The U.S. was engaged, as was trying to improve its relationship with China, and unipolar moment was going on, and things were perceived differently. This next question is asking about civilian resilience. And so how important is civilian preparedness to Taiwan's overall deterrence posture?
I think there's a lot of talk about that. I mean, that's an interesting question because I mean, I think part of the desire for asymmetric warfare is, it's designed that things need to be hardened, things need to be decentralized because Taiwan's going to get hit by a lot of missiles. And I think there's a recognition that there's going to be, I mean, in the event of any conflict, I think there would be quite a few, casualties, not just in the major cities, but all around. If you were in an airplane flying around when something happened, boy, that's going to be dangerous for, 747s flying in and out of Taipei, flying from Japan to Hong Kong. I mean, the Taiwan Strait would be a dangerous place for maritime traffic, right? But what does that mean for Taiwan's civilian population? I think there's an issue that the culture of a lot of countries, again, as Americans, we have maybe a different view, but let me give an example. Most people in Taiwan have never fired a weapon, right? Firearms use is extremely restricted in Taiwan, firearms and ammunition. There was an idea a couple of years ago, a member of the Taiwanese legislature said, why doesn't the military train civilians, right? In case, heaven forbid, anything ever happened. And the military just said, well, that seems like a lot of trouble. We don't really have the space. We don't really have the time. So there's still a, I think the military is kind of a little bit ambiguous on that, on how to engage with the civilian population. The other side of that coin is that Taiwan still has, we've seen here in the United States, slow progression of women in the military, women in combat roles. I think Taiwan is still not super comfortable with that. I think that's a question that it would have to be answered, right? Because that's 50% of the population. And as of now, women can volunteer, they can serve in the military. They're not conscripted. And so the number of women with military training is obviously much lower. So those are kind of the two aspects that I think would need to be resolved, is sort of the military's desire to engage with the public, and then sort of this gender issue.
So let's just take this one last question and pull further on what you're talking about. It's about civil military trust. And so, how important then is this public trust in the military to a nation's ability to deter aggression?
I think it's important in a couple ways. One is support for the military, and that, one of the real backbones of the United States is that I forget the exact number, but it's this massive number of people in the military are overwhelmingly, they had a family member who served, whether it was a parent, a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle. If people in Taiwan can say the same thing, if they can say, oh, I knew someone, I had a classmate who went in the military, he enjoyed it, he thought it was fulfilling. I think that will help solve some of these personnel issues. It will also, I think there's a spillover effect there with funding, right? Because if you say, oh, they're not just, spending the money on, fancy gizmos or whoever, whatever, they're buying, weapon systems. They're meant to protect us, they're meant to defend us. That's one thing where I think Taiwan's military is much better now than it was 20 years ago. That, for example, they have a open house, right? You can go to a Navy ship; it's parked in port. You can't exactly walk around the CIC and look at the radar, but you can walk around deck. You can take some photos. It's part of the community, if you will, in a way that maybe it wouldn't have been in the 1970s or 1980s. And so I think those kind of things making the military, again, part of a normal sort of society where they are a servant of society instead of apart from it. Maybe a little more work for the officers to have all those civilians running around deck taking selfies. But in the long term, I think that's the kind of thing that is a strength of Taiwan that's going to carry over into the future.
Eric, this has been a wonderful hour together. Congratulations on your book, On the Brink, and thank you for sharing it with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah. As we conclude today's dialogue, Taiwan's story reminds us that military power is built over generations, not simply through weapons, but through institutions, leadership, alliances, and the resilience of free society. History cannot predict the future, but it can help us better understand the choices that shape it. My thanks to Dr. Eric Setzkorn for helping us explore one of the Indo-Pacific's most important security stories. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining us. These conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha oi. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.